Education Committee Omnibus Finance Bill will come to order. And welcome to all of the conferees. Representative Jennifer Loon, very pleased to start off our meeting on House File 844. I thought maybe we would start off our meeting today by having the members of the conference committee introduce themselves, and then we'll introduce nonpartisan staff. So, again, I've introduced myself, and Senator or Representative Erickson, if you want to go ahead.
Good afternoon, Sandra Erickson. I represent East Central Minnesota and am the chair of Innovation Policy in the House.
And State Representative Bob Detmer from Forest Lake area, House District 39A, and I chair the Veterans Division.
My name is Representative Roz Peterson, and I represent the areas of Burnsville-Lakeville in House District 56B.
And our nonpartisan House staff, if you'd go ahead and introduce yourselves.
Madam Chair, my name is Tim Strom. I'm with House Research.
Madam Chair, my name is Melissa Johnson. I'm the fiscal analyst for the Education House Education Finance Committee.
Madam Chair, I'm Lisa Larson from House Research.
Thank you. And why don't we go ahead and have Senate, we'll just go around the table, Senate nonpartisan, introduce yourselves.
Yes, Madam Chair. Anne-Marie Butler, Senate Counsel.
Madam Chair, my name is Jay Wilms, Senate Fiscal.
Madam Chair, Bjorn Arneson, Senate Legislative Analyst.
Eric Pratt, Senate District 55, which is Scott County. I represent the communities and school districts of Prior Lake, Shakopee, and Jordan.
Senator Kevin Dahl from Northfield, Senate District 20. I represent communities in parts of Rice, Lesore, and Scott County.
I'm Senator Alice Johnson from Anoka County, District 37. My cities are Blaine, Coon Rapids, and Spring Lake Park.
Leroy Stumpf, State Senator from Northwestern Minnesota. I represent six counties up in Senate District 1.
And Madam Chair, I'm Chuck Wigger. I'm in my 19th year. My district is 43, and that includes North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale, White Bear, Matamidi, Birchwood, and Willerney. And we look very forward to sharing our collective passion on students and what we can do to maximize opportunity for them.
Right. Well, thank you. Thank you all. And I guess I just said my name but didn't say where I represent from. I'm Representative Jennifer Loon from Eden Prairie. And I very much look forward to this process. Senator Wigger and I have had some nice discussions, and I think this will be a great conference committee to be part of. So I welcome all of you, and thanks also to the members of the public who are in the audience. I know that you all have a vested interest in all of our children and seeing them succeed as we do as well. So looking forward to this process. So just a couple of items, and then we'll turn to doing a walkthrough of the differences between the bills, and I think we'll start with the policy language. So I'm assuming nonpartisan staff has worked out who's going to cover what articles, and then we'll do the spreadsheets afterwards. There's clearly some differences between the House and the Senate bill, and I'll turn to Senator Wigger in a moment. But just for the public to understand, the House proposal and what we aim to do was to try to, first of all, prioritize money to our schools and on the formula, and in also in placing a priority on funding and providing more money where we can on those programs with a demonstrated record of success. Really trying to identify those programs that are helping to close the achievement gap and putting more resources into those programs was something that we very much sought to prioritize. We also wanted to partner that with as much local control as possible to our districts so that they have the ability to harness their innovative and interesting and exciting ideas that will work in the best interest of the students in their communities and in their schools. And that is something I know many of us in this room all feel strongly about. So as we go through and hear the differences and then get down to the business of developing our compromise and our final proposals, the House proposal, we did dedicate 62% of our targeted funds to increasing the formula, and I know that's important to many people here. We also put 25% of our targeted funds into early learning scholarships and school readiness, so an early learning area. So a very important thing, early childhood, to making sure that we are closing the achievement gap really before that achievement gap gets into our into kindergarten, and that's an incredibly important thing to do. We may have differences of opinion on how we get there, but I know that the desire to make a strong push on quality early childhood education is something, that a goal that we all share. So with that, we've got a tremendously diverse state, children from diverse backgrounds, diverse families, but I know that we can craft a bill together that will serve all of those children well and make sure that we are indeed giving every child in Minnesota a world-class education. So with that, I'll turn it over to Senator Wieger for any comments he'd like to make.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We share your priority that the majority of our increased spending for the target should go toward formula. And as everyone knows, Representative Luna and I don't set that target. We'd like to. It would be much higher, and it's our hope that it will be by the leadership that's negotiating, and we'll just wait and see when that happens. We have substantially more dollars. Proportionately, you had to work within your target. We put in 1.1%, about $170 million. But top priority, like yours, for the budget would be to increase formula. We also share your priority for Ready for K, for early learning. We have a higher value on the school readiness program. It's a program that's been in place for 24 years, highly successful, working with 3-4-year-olds primarily, and we did not feel there were sufficient funds to roll out the universal pre-K-4, which the executive branch, the governor, has advocated, given that that would exceed our target in and of itself. But we thought this would be the best way to accomplish that. For scholarships, that's in the mix. We have that as a part of what we have, is in addition, provisions for ECFE. So we are each committed to Ready for K, and we'll further examine best strategies and how we can create a win-win. We also have a very high priority on school facilities. There's a $300 plus differential right now for the amount of spending that goes toward students, whether you are in a large district, the top 25, or the other districts, and the so-called alternative facilities bonding program. Recommendations in 2013 asked that we have a level playing field, and we have this in our bill. One of the best examples of why we need this was in Forest Lake, showing deteriorated buildings. And but this story was throughout the state, and you know, we'll learn more about why we value this. And another important program that we thank Governor Plenty for and acknowledge it worked, and that's QComp. And we want all districts to have that eligibility to lift the cap. And we'll emphasize that. We have a number of provisions on vocational education. And I'll mention, in addition, on policy, as these things are interwoven, we have a couple of key items that we share as well. Streamlining the licensing process for teachers and the testing of teachers. We recognize it's a mess right now. We want high-quality teachers, and we need to expedite that process. We also are very concerned about the number of tests that students need to take. Let's reduce testing in a responsible way. We have recommendations in our bill, and I might add, this was bipartisan in our committee. We're pleased Senator Pratt is here with us, and our policy bill members was unanimous by committee members on the Senate floor. So wanted to share that, and working out a bipartisan bill on policy issues, and look forward to us reaching an agreement as we approach the next several days.
Very good. Well, and I know we will. That is our work, and I think we are all looking forward to it, and And there's very good ideas here to work with, and I know that where there are differences, we will develop consensus and, again, do what is in the best interest of our students. So I thank you, Senator Wieger, and again, I'm truly delighted to be working with all of you on this conference committee. So with that, I think we'll go ahead and start the walkthrough of the policy language, beginning with Article 1.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, there's two documents that have been put together for you. The reviser has put together the language side by side with the actual language in the bills. The House file, which is House File 844, is on the left side this year. On the right side are the two Senate files that we're considering with the House file. Those are Senate Files 811 and Senate File 1495. So the House will show up on the left, the Senate on the right, on both the summary and the text language. On the text language that the reviser put together for us, each article, the page numbers start again. So the page number routine will say R1 for the first page and then A1 for Article 1. When we get to R2 then, or to Article 2, the R's will start again at 1 and the article will be at 2. So that'll help you keep your order there. On the summary is organized the same way with the House on the left and the Senate on the right. And then there's a middle column on the summary that points out some of the differences or the similarities of the two sets of provisions. Best always, if there's a specific thing you're looking for or looking at, to look at the actual language in the bills itself. But those are the documents that we'll be working from. And House and Senate staff will be alternating as we go through these provisions. We'll start and basically work down the side until there's an area where the other side has something that the House or Senate does not have, and that person will take over. So, Madam Chair, we'll be switching back and forth a bit, too. So, with that said, Article 1 is the general education article, and the first provision is one of six provisions or seven provisions that deal with the flexible school year, the learning year program. The House and Senate language in all six provisions is nearly identical, with the exception of the first section here, where the Senate has a particular reference and the House has a more general reference. The intent of both provisions is the same, but this is in Article 1, Section 1, length of the school year, the hours of instruction. Essentially, the authority for flexible learning years is given to the school boards, taken away from the commissioner and given to school boards. Section 2 of the House bill is the definition of general education revenue for charter schools. And general education revenue is changed in two ways, one substantive and one non here. The extended time program is renamed, so that change appears in paragraph, the first paragraph of the subdivision. And in paragraph B, under the House proposal, charter schools would be eligible for extended time funding equal to 25% of the state average for extended time funding for school districts beginning in fiscal year 2016. Madam Chair, members, then sections 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 of the House bill are also the flexible learning year program. And as I mentioned previously, those are identical in the Senate as well.
Madam Chair, on page R3A1, on the Senate side, it's marked career and technical revenue. This is a provision with no comparable provision in the House bill. The new language at lines 3.18 and 3.24 would make explicit that qualifying non-licensed community expert salaries are eligible for reimbursement. Additionally, at line 3.16, the proportion of expenditures eligible for career and tech revenue is increased from 35% to 37.5%. There is some stricken language on the next page, obsolete language, and then the new language in paragraph C makes clear that salaries for these non-licensed community experts only qualify for the reimbursement if the district first makes an effort to obtain licensed teachers. Section 4 is the definition of general education revenue. In both the House and Senate sides, there's a stricken paragraph A. It's obsolete language. The effect of both House and Senate is the same. the House strikes some additional language at the beginning of paragraph B that is obsolete and makes the updated reference to extended support revenue. On page R5A1, this is the definition of basic revenue or the formula allowance. Both the House and Senate strike some unneeded language, though the Senate takes a little bit heavier pen there and strikes the first sentence, which would be obsolete. And the Senate position is to increase the formula allowance by $58 or 1% in fiscal year 16 and an additional 1% in fiscal year 17 and later.
Madam Chair, members, the House in the same formula allowance increases it by 0.6%, $34 the first year and or $33 the first year and $34 the second year, but 0.6% in the House formula increases. In Section 10 on page R5, a couple of changes to extended time revenue. The first is the name change. The second is the House adds $100 per pupil on line 5.14, increasing for all school districts the amount of extended time revenue that they would get. And then in the paragraph B makes two sets of changes. The first of those adding some terms for some of the extended week programs and extended time programs such as vacation break academies and spring break academies. And then second, the very last sentence authorizes the extended support revenue to be used by an area learning center for high school students for programs during the school day.
Madam Chair, in that corresponding paragraph B, the Senate language is slightly different. It does make reference to area learning centers, but also to alternative learning programs and contract alternative programs. This was a technical suggestion the Senate received from the agency with regard to this provision.
Madam Chair, members, in Section 11, the local optional revenue, which was created 2 years ago in the Tax Committee, the House bill this year adds an additional component to the equalizing factor and provides some additional state aid and property tax relief for those school districts where more than 30% of the value is in cabin property or seasonal recreational property. On the next page, on R6, Section 12 of the House bill is the change to compensatory revenue. Compensatory revenue for the existing formula allowance of $5,831 per pupil stays unchanged. But for future increases in the formula allowance, under the House proposal, the increase in the formula allowance above $5,831, the compensatory would be distributed on a non-concentrated basis simply on the count of the free plus one-half of the reduced number of pupils eligible for reduced-price lunch. That change, as I said, is on the margin for formula increases above the $5,831 per pupil. Section 13 of the House bill relates to the operating capital levy. The House is simply removing some obsolete words from that section.
Madam Chair and members, and this is the first of a few cases throughout the side-by-side where members will see language from the Senate policy bill and then consecutively language from the Senate finance bill. They might amend the same section in different ways, and I'll try and sort of integrate those together as I speak about it. So Section 1 on the Senate side is just as Mr. Strom described. The next section, marked Section 7 at line 5.17, is the method by which the Senate offsets levy increases elsewhere in the Senate fiscal bill. So it increases, this provision increases the operating capital equalizing factor for fiscal years 17, 18, and 19, and this results in some levy savings in operating capital levy. The next provision, transportation sparsity revenue allowance, the new language is actually on the next page in both the House and Senate, and in some respects it looks similar, though the kind of order of operations is a little bit different, in that while both proposals sort of have the same intent and affect the same set of districts, the end result is slightly different. So this would increase transportation sparsity aid for districts that are larger than 525 square miles, and for the St. Louis County District, which is larger than 3,000 square miles.
And Madam Chair, on the House provision, the change is quite similar in the districts affected, but as the order of calculations is affected, essentially a slightly different revenue amount, and when we get per pupil funding printouts, we'll see the difference that change causes. The next change, Madam Chair, Section 15 on the equity revenue on lines on page 9, the top of the page there, the House essentially provides the 25% increase that goes for Metro School District equity formula to all school districts in the state.
The Senate language, the student achievement rate, the Senate position is to push back the date by which the commissioner must establish this student achievement rate from July 1st to September 30th. This was a provision in the agency's policy language as introduced. The next section, general education aid, is the definition of general education aid. There's a bunch of stricken obsolete language there on page R9. The new language on the Senate side is at the line marked 3.7, and it inserts a reference to operating capital aid that was mistakenly omitted when this section was last amended in 2013.
And Madam Chair, members, the House difference is the House repeals the student achievement levy, and as a result, there's a slight difference in the in the order of the calculations there. In Section 17 on the uses of basic skills revenue, the uses of compensatory revenue, starting on page 11, the House authorizes to expand the use of basic skills revenue to include teacher recruitment and teacher development activities through mentor-led induction or other local initiatives. It also clarifies the provision related to the use of the funding for four-year-olds or other early education programs. Section 18 of the House bill has to do with the allocation of compensatory revenue. What this provision allows is the school board to make the decision of how much of the compensatory revenue to allocate to each of the school sites within the district boundaries.
Madam Chair and members, the Senate language is similar in concept, except that the Senate language would allow the school board to reallocate only up to 50% of the compensatory revenue, according to a plan adopted by the board.
Madam Chair, members, Section 19 of the House is simply a corresponding change to go with Section 18 and reflect that the school board is making the allocation decisions. Section 20 of the House and Section 21 of the House are the same as the Senate provisions, having to do with the calculation of the referendum revenue.
Madam Chair and members, on page R15A1, there's a Senate provision marked Section 6, taconite payment and other reductions. This would clarify that the student achievement levy is excluded from those levies that are subject to the taconite reduction. The next provision is on the next page, marked R16, general education funding. This is similar to language that was described earlier, and this makes that same conforming change to the name of extended support revenue to the definition of gen ed revenue for the Crosswinds School. The next several sections all relate to the formation of an intermediate district in the Southwest Metro. And I think I'll just sort of describe in very high level what the sections do. So Section 11 names the districts that can enter into the agreement, and I should say that many of these sections are substantially similar to provisions that already exist in law for the other three intermediate districts that exist now. Section 12 describes the board, the members of the bylaws. Section 13 describes the status of the board as a public agency, its liability and tax exemption. Section 14 It makes clear that the joint board has all the powers of its member districts. Section 15 requires each member board to adopt a resolution before the agreement to become an intermediate district becomes effective, and requires publication. Section 16 makes clear that participating or member school districts can contribute funds to the board. It describes the way that the funds can be dispersed. Section 17 indicates that the joint intermediate agreement can specify the term of the agreement. Section 18 makes clear that any jointly provided educational programs cannot be post-secondary programs or services. Section 19, other membership and powers. Again, many of these things are similar to the provisions already in law for other immediate districts. Section 20 ensures that for the 2015-16 school year only, for an intermediate district formed under these provisions, the department must calculate compensatory revenue based on the prior year pupil counts for the South Metro Educational Cooperative. Because compensatory revenue is calculated on a prior year basis, there wouldn't be a prior year in the first year of an intermediate district. Section 21, and I should say that's the end of the intermediate district sections. On page R19, Section 21 on the Senate side would exempt Hendricks School District from the reciprocity agreement with South Dakota. Section 22 would require the commissioner to make adjustments to school district tax rates and equalizing factors if a tax bill changed the underlying statewide total tax capacity either in the current regular session or a subsequent special session. Section, and I should say the effect of this provision would be to bring the changes caused by the tax bill in terms of the aid levy mix, bring those changes closer to zero than they would exist without this language. Section 23 clarifies the referendum revenue allowance for Owatonna Public Schools. The Senate position, the Senate received testimony that the ballot was not clear, and therefore this language provides in law the referendum allowance for the Owatonna Public Schools. Section 24 on the Senate and Section 22 on the House side begin the appropriations section, and perhaps Madam Chair wishes to wait on any detail of that until we walk through the appropriations spreadsheet.
Yes, let's do that.
Okay. Then we'll skip to page R23 and the repealers. This is going to be another case where some of the House and Senate repealers are carried in different articles or different bills, and so we'll try and be clear as to which repealers are actually carried in both the House and Senate. So on the Senate side, the three provisions repealed all originated from the agency bill. And paragraph B of the Senate repealer repeals the rules related to flexible learning year program.
Madam Chair, members, because of the way the revisor document's formatted, it may be the one case where the summary is really more helpful for specifics than the text for the repealers. We've tried to line those up across from each other with each individual repealer listed. So in the summary, you can see that on the House side, the annual report on expenditures of learning development revenues repealed, the student achievement levies repealed, and then the two provisions that my Senate counterpart just mentioned that are the same include the obsolete health insurance costs and the rule regarding the commissioner's authority for flexible school year programs. And those are on page 9 of the summary. And Madam Chair, I think that's it for Article 1.
Well, any questions? Okay, we'll move on to Article 2. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, then starting on page R1 of Article 2, On the right-hand side is the Senate file, and Section 1 there related to directory information just updates reference to federal law on the classification of data on public data on individuals that are part of the directory information. Then, Madam Chair, members, the next section is the same in both the House file and the Senate file, and that just strikes references to the Minnesota World Language Proficiency High Achievement certificates, which are later, the name is later changed. And then, I guess, Section 3 and Section 3 of the House file, Section 5 of the Senate file, which is towards the middle of the page of R2, are similar. That is then where the name of the certificates are changed and updated. It also directs what assessment needs to be and what level of attainment needs to be achieved on those assessments, and then allows for criteria to be established for awarding college credit based on those seals or based on the exams.
Madam Chair, members, as Ms. Butler indicated, the two provisions are similar, but there are a few details that are distinct. In the House, the language requires that students, in order to receive a gold or platinum seal, must demonstrate the requisite level of language proficiency in grade 10, 11, or 12. There is language encouraging the University of Minnesota to award credits, and the House has an immediate effective date that would apply to students who graduate in the 2014-2015 school year. Section 4 in the House that appears on R4 is similar to the provision in the Senate. The House and Senate both outline requirements for local literacy plans.
The difference of that section in the Senate file, if you look on page R5, line 13.6, the Senate includes a description of how schools in the district will provide explicit and systematic instruction in basic phonology and language decoding skills. Then the next section is the rigorous course taking, and that was part of a PSEO bill, and it includes then career and tech education courses that are offered as concurrent enrollment in the rigorous course taking report that's already completed by the commissioner. And that's the same in both bills.
Madam Chair, members, on pages R6 to R8, the House sections 6, 7, and 8 have no comparable provisions in the Senate. They have to do with collecting data on student homelessness. Section 9 of the House, for which there is no Senate companion, appears on R8 of the side-by-side. It would require a public school student restroom, locker room, changing room, and shower room that is accessible to multiple students at the same time to be used exclusively by either male or female students, as that is defined in this section.
Then on down to R9, sections 2 and 3 in the Senate file are the Student Support Services Personnel Grant Program, which is not a comparable House position. And then, Madam Chair and members, the operative language starts actually on R11. It's House File Section 10 and the Senate Policy Bill Section 18 is the beginning of several sections related to teacher licensure and those requirements, and they are not quite comparable. The Senate file requires candidates to demonstrate a passing score on a board adopted skills examination. Requires the Board of Teaching to provide accommodations for a individual candidate that produces documentation of a disability. And then also, if you skip down to R14, 28.24, paragraph O of the Senate file, in comparison to the House file, the Senate lists items that the Board of Teachers had taken into consideration when licensing teachers from out of state, as well as licensed or prepared an alternative preparation programs, where the House file at least has language requiring adoption of rules.
Madam Chair, members, as Ms. Butler indicated, there are quite a number of similarities in these two proposals, and certainly one might suggest that the goals are somewhat similar. The House language in this section and other sections that appear in Article 2 allow teacher licensure candidates to submit essentially equivalent ACT or SAT passing scores in lieu of college-level skills tests. There is a direction to the Board of Teaching to adopt rules to license out-of-state teacher candidates consistent with the criteria that are listed in this section. Madam Chair, members, Section 11, which begins on R14, and Section 4 the Senate appear to have similar goals, but the Senate file is much abbreviated as compared to the House. The House language directs the Board of Teaching and the Board of School Administrators, in cooperation with MACD and board-approved teacher preparation programs, to collect and report summary data both on teachers and school administrators' preparation and performance outcomes. There is a direction to collect summary data on teacher candidates and recent graduates, direction to school districts to report to the Board of Teaching on teachers who finish their probationary period and accept a continuing contract, on probationary teachers who are released or whose contracts are not renewed. There is a direction to school districts to report information to the Board of School Administrators on school principals who accept a continuing contract and those who are released or whose contracts are not renewed.
Madam Chair, members, the Senate file is a direction to the teacher preparation programs as instead of the Board of Teaching or the Board of School Administrators, and the prep programs are then required to report the summary data and on the program's efficacy, as well as listing outcomes such as graduation rates, employment rates, and such.
Madam Chair, members, Section 12 of the House, Section 4 of the Senate appears beginning on R16. The House directs the Board of Teaching to publish on its website summary data on teacher preparation program outcomes.
Where the Senate has the teacher preparation programs putting that data on their websites. Then, Madam Chair, members, the operative language is on R17, Section 13 of the House file, Section 19 of the Senate file, and that relates to continuing education requirements for principals. It strikes some language where retired principals were not required to have the continuing education requirements being met.
Madam Chair, members, also on R17 of the revisor side-by-side, Section 14 in the House on reporting principal preparation program data, that's consistent with the earlier section on collecting and reporting data. This is a direction to the Board of School Administrators to publish summary data on principal preparation program outcomes. Madam Chair, members, Section 15 in the House, also beginning on R17, which is across from Section 20 in the Senate, requires the Board of Teaching to license qualified out-of-state teaching candidates. It directs the Board of Teaching to allow candidates to submit, and again, this is the language that's consistent throughout the House proposal, essentially the requisite essentially equivalent ACT or SAT scores in lieu of the college-level skills test score, which is a phrase that also appears in the House but not in the Senate. There is a direction to the Board of Teaching to issue an additional license to a teacher who is employed by a district or charter school and who agrees to try to pass either the skills exam or attain the requisite ACT or SAT score. at the request of that employing district or charter school, the House directs the Board of Teaching to issue a standard license to a teacher who, after being granted a third temporary teaching license, is determined by the district or charter school to have been an effective teacher during those three consecutive years when the teacher taught under a one-year temporary teaching license.
Whereas, Madam Chair and members, the Senate file requires the candidate to pass a or demonstrate a passing score on a board-adopted examination of skills, as and striking the language related to the ACT and SAT. In addition, the Senate file allows the Board of Teaching to issue up to four instead of two temporary one-year teaching licenses to a candidate who has not yet passed the board-adopted skills exam. Then on the Senate file side, on R19, Section 21 allows the Board of Teaching to grant a two-year provisional license to a candidate that's in a field where they were not previously licensed or in a field where there's a shortage of licensed teachers. And then it defines what is meant by a shortage. And then, Madam Chair, members, Section 16 and on the House file, Section 22 on the Senate file, the operative language is in R20, lists offenses for which a teacher's license may be revoked.
Madam Chair, members, the two provisions that Ms. Butler just described are essentially the same with one difference. There is a reference in the House bill to Section 609.322, Subdivision 1, that has to do with sex trafficking in the second degree. That is in the House bill, but not the Senate. Madam Chair, members, on R20 of your side-by-side licensure via portfolio, the House proposes to require the Board of Teaching to notify candidates who submit a portfolio for teacher licensure, whether the licensing division at the department has approved their portfolio, and also to give them information about how to revise their portfolio if they are not approved to successfully demonstrate the requisite competence.
Madam Chair, members, the Senate file has a similar timeline for notification. However, the portfolios are submitted to the Board of Teaching as opposed to the Educator Licensing Division at the department. Then, Madam Chair, members, Section 18 of the House file and Section 24 of the Senate file are another example of the teacher licensure provisions that are dissimilar, although there are similarities as far as the date to have criteria for procedures related to applicants trained in other states.
Yes, Madam Chair, members, in the House, there is a direction to the Board of Teaching to issue a Minnesota teaching license to an out-of-state applicant who meets certain specified criteria that are listed in the subdivision. For example, it might be possible under this provision to issue a standard license based on an out-of-state applicant's teaching experiences and exams if the applicant were to have, for example, 2 years of teaching experience as the teacher of record in a similar licensure field, among other criteria. In Subdivision 3 of that section, there is a direction to the Board of Teaching to enter into interstate agreements for teacher licensure that allow licensed teachers from adjoining states to receive a Minnesota teaching license. There is also a direction to the Board before issuing the license and entering into these agreements to determine that the requirements in the adjoining state are comparable. It allows the Board to limit agreements to particular content areas or grade levels based on established priorities or shortages, and there is language encouraging the Board to work with adjoining states to establish reciprocal interstate agreements. Madam Chair, members, on R24 of the side-by-side, Section 19 in the House, Section 25 in the Senate, There is some language that's the same, and then there is additional language in the House. It allows certain nonprofit corporations to organize for an education purpose to acquire, to allow candidates to acquire limited term licenses in preparation for a standard teaching license. It would require a person with a limited term license to take either the skills test or attain the ACT passing scores. And there's some clarifying language in both bills.
Then, so the Senate file requires the candidate to demonstrate the passing score on a board-approved skills exam and limits the ability of a nonprofit corporation organized for an educated-related purpose only when they're partnering with a college or university that has a board-approved alternative teacher prep program.
Madam Chair, members, on R25, Section 20 in the House, for which there is no comparable Senate provision, defines non-traditional means for purposes of alternative teacher preparation programs. The language directs the Board of Teaching to use non-traditional criteria to determine the qualification of program instructors and allows the Board to recognize instructors holding only a bachelor's degree. Section 21 in the House, Section 26 in the Senate are similar. Again, the House talks describes the skills exam as a college-level exam. The House directs the Board of Teaching to issue a license to a qualified teacher who attains qualifying test scores on the various tests needed for licensure.
In the Senate file, instead of stating a rigorous college-level skills exam, has the board-approved rigorous skills exam.
Madam Chair, members, Section 22 in the House that appears on R25 of your side-by-side has no comparable Senate provision. The topic is non-licensed community experts. The House proposes to allow districts and charter schools to hire non-licensed community experts after trying to obtain acceptable licensed teachers for particular courses or subject areas. There is a requirement to notify a student's parent before placing that student in the classroom of such a non-licensed community expert. Madam Chair, members, Section 23 in the House and Section 27 in the Senate are similar. They appear beginning on R26. It creates an exemption for technical education instructors with the approval of the local school board employing the individual. It's possible to exempt that part-time vocational or career and technical education program teacher from teacher licensure requirements.
The Senate language has an explanation that the section doesn't exclude a licensed career and technical educator from the definition of teacher in various sections related to contracts and collective bargaining, as well as on 36.33, the Senate has the section expiring in June 30, 2020.
Madam Chair, members, on R27 of your side-by-side, Section 24 in the House has no comparable Senate provision. This is part of the proposal in House File 2. It would allow a local school board to negotiate an unrequested leave of absence for probationary teachers. Madam Chair, members, Section 25 in the House, 28 in the Senate, beginning on R28, has a similar goal in both bodies. The House proposes to prohibit school administrators from placing students in the classroom of a teacher with the lowest evaluation rating in the previous school year unless no other teacher is available.
The Senate language on R30 limits the placement of students with teachers with a teacher who's in an improvement process or who has not had a summative evaluation.
Madam Chair, members, Section 26 in the House on R30 of your side-by-side has no Senate companion. It has to do with negotiated unrequested leaves of absence beginning in the 2017-2018 school year. This language would require school boards to place teachers on unrequested leaves of absence based on their licensure field, evaluation outcomes, and effectiveness category or rating, and other locally determined criteria such as teacher seniority. Among other elements in this section, there is an appeal process established to determine whether the district met certain teacher evaluation requirements. The section also prohibits using categories to place a teacher on unrequested leave of absence if the principal who evaluates the teacher is on an improvement plan. Section 27 of the House, again, there is no Senate companion. It appears on R32 of your side-by-side. Among other provisions in this section, the language proposes to make the 5-year right to reinstatement applicable to teachers who are placed on unrequested leave of absence who are categorized as effective or better. So that's a 5-year right. And it would propose to terminate after one school year, the right to reinstatement of those teachers who are categorized as ineffective or less. Section 28 of the House, again, there is no Senate companion. It appears on R34. This is consistent with other language in House File 2, as well as a proposal from Representative Bennett. It requires a school board to immediately discharge a continuing contract teacher whose license is revoked due to having been convicted for child abuse, including child sexual abuse. Section 29 in the House that appears on R36 does not have a Senate companion. This applies to first-class city school districts. These are the same House File 2 provisions as previously discussed, allowing a local school board to negotiate a plan for discontinuing or terminating probationary teachers. A number of these sections are duplicated because, as you know, we have provisions that apply to teachers generally, and we also have provisions that apply to teachers teaching in a school district located in a first-class city school district. Section 30 of the House, Section 29 of the Senate. Again, this is a provision that Ms. Butler and I described. It appears on R37. The House is proposing to prohibit school administrators from placing teachers in the classroom of a teacher with the lowest evaluation in the previous school year unless no other teacher at the school is available.
And the Senate file has the same language, again, about the teacher being in the improvement process or has not had a summative evaluation.
Madam Chair, members, Section 32 in the House, for which there is no Senate companion, appears on R41. For the 2017-2018 school year and later, it would require the school board of a first-class city school district and the exclusive representative of the teachers to negotiate a plan to discontinue and terminate teachers based on their licensure field, evaluation outcomes, and effectiveness category or rating, and other locally determined criteria, such as teacher seniority. The language establishes parameters for effecting the plan. It establishes a hearing process to establish whether the district met certain teacher evaluation criteria. And among other provisions, it also prohibits, again, as it did in the previous section for teachers generally, prohibits using evaluation outcomes and effectiveness categories to place a teacher on unrequested leave of absence if the principal who evaluates the teacher is on an improvement plan.
Then, Madam Chair, members, down towards the bottom of R42 in Article 2, is one of many sections of the Senate file that relate to QComp and allowing cooperatives to participate in QComp. That would be Section 5, helps define the cooperatives. Section 6 is the plan components. Section 7 is, again, cooperatives is in the restructured pay system. Section 8 is the allowing for a planning year to transition from into the alternative teacher professional pay system. And then on R45, and it would be House File Section 33 and the Senate File Section 9 gets into the
the elements of the pay system, and I believe they have some comparable language relating to the reformed salary schedule, and allows for a hiring bonus and other compensations for teachers who work in hard-to-fill positions or hard-to-staff school settings.
Madam Chair, members, on the House side for Section 33 that begins on R45, the House also includes language that would allow the alternative teacher professional pay system to include incentives for teachers to obtain a master's degree in their content field of licensure or pursue additional licensure in a shortage area or help fund a Grow Your Own Teacher initiative and to provide for teacher-powered site-governed schools.
Then continuing on to the bottom half of R46 of Article 2 is the application requirements for cooperatives for the QCOMP. And then Section 11, it would be including cooperatives in the approval process once they submit their applications. Then Section 12 is funding for the cooperatives or if they are participating in QCOMP. Then Section 13, at the bottom, towards the bottom of R48, is the revenue amounts and timing and what their what the formula is for determining the cooperative units and their their QCOMP, and as well as it also deals with intermediates in that calculation.
Madam Chair, members, Sections 34 beginning on R51 and 35 on R54 of the House bill have to do with staff development program and revenue. The Senate does not have these provisions. The House is proposing to require school boards to use staff development revenue for teacher and principal development and evaluation plans, in-service education programs, and other staff development needs. There is a requirement that staff development plans make staff development outcomes part of the district agreement for teacher development and evaluation and include procedures to evaluate progress toward meeting those outcomes. There is also a direction to the Advisory Staff Development Committee to adopt a plan that is consistent with the Agreement on Development and Evaluation for developing and evaluating teachers, improving student outcomes, and consistent with the principal evaluation process. Section 35, which has to do with the staff development revenue, would require school districts to reserve at least 2% of basic revenue for teacher and principal professional development and evaluation and for in-service training. It also allows staff development revenue to be used for other specified purposes to the extent extra funds are available. Madam Chair, members, on R55, Section 36 in the House and Section 30 in the Senate are the same. This proposes to require student teachers to be placed with a cooperating licensed teacher who has at least 3 years of teaching experience and is not in a teacher improvement process. Section 37 in the House has no Senate companion. It appears on R55 of your side-by-side. It allows school districts to develop and implement a mentoring program for teachers who are new to the profession or district, and to provide mentoring programs to other teachers as well. It requires these programs to support the TD&E and peer review processes, and it allows school districts to use staff development revenue or other funds to pay a mentor stipend. That mentor may be a district employee or a third-party contractor. Section 38 in the House on teacher assignments, it appears on R56, has no Senate companion. For purposes of district consolidation, it assigns the most effective teacher with the greatest seniority to the district receiving the most students and assigns other teachers as well.
Madam Chair and members, R56, halfway down Section 14 of the Senate files, was once the Principal's Leadership Institute, is now Principal Leadership Development. It allows the commissioner to contract with both Minnesota State University Mankato and the Regents of the University of Minnesota to provide a professional development for principals. In addition, it outlines how the application and selection process and requires academies to be delivered annually in the Severn County metro area as well as in greater Minnesota.
Madam Chair, members, both the House and the Senate have proposals on teacher-powered schools, but they are not the same. Section 39 of the House that appears on R58 takes existing law and makes an amendment consistent throughout to refer specifically to these schools as teacher-powered schools.
And the Senate file, where the language can be found on beginning on R61, provides a grant program for teacher-powered schools. Section 40 of the House file and Section 16 of the Senate file are similar. The Senate file allows 9th or 10th grade students' eligibility to participate in a concurrent enrollment course is at the discretion of the school district and the eligible post-secondary institution providing the course, instead of only being eligible after all the 11th and 12th grade students have applied for the course, and they need more students to offer it.
Madam Chair, members, both bodies also propose to amend this same section to allow 9th and 10th grade students to take a world language course that is available for 11th and 12th grade students. The House requires that the course be consistent with the world language standards and the proficiency seals and certificates discussed earlier in this article. Madam Chair, members, Section 41 of the House, Section 32 of the Senate on R63, allows a student in grade 10 who did not take the MCA reading test in grade 8 to substitute another reading assessment in order to enroll in a PSEO program. This is language proposed by the department in their policy bill. Section 42 in the House, Section 17 in the Senate, removes the limits on PSEO participation for students who are not on track to graduate. If I recall correctly, this was also a department proposal. Section 43 in the House, Section 33 in the Senate on R64 of your side-by-side strikes in the House, strikes a prohibition against advertising the educational, programmatic, and financial benefits of PSEO courses to post-secondary students, and also allows students who are enrolled in the graduation incentive program to enroll full-time in middle or early college programs, having a pathway to a post-secondary degree or credential. Madam Chair, members, Section 44 in the House that appears on R65 has no Senate companion. It requires all MNSCU institutions to give full credit to a student who, as a high school PSEO student, completes a PSEO course or program for post-secondary credit and subsequently enrolls in any particular, in any MNSCU institution. Section 45 of the House on R66 of your side-by-side has no Senate companion. It directs post-secondary institutions providing concurrent enrollment courses to implement national program standards.
Madam Chair, members, down to R67, Article 2 is Senate-only provision for full-service community schools. Require or allows for grants to be awarded to such schools. And that will take you down to R73, and that's Section 19 of the Senate file, for which there is not a comparable House provision. And that is another grant program for innovative incubator service learning grants. And then after that, Madam Chair members, is R75, and that is section 47 of the Senate file, and that is related. There are several sections, but this one is Senate only, related to the American Indian Education Act, and has some updates that I think were submitted by the department.
Madam Chair, members, to Ms. Butler's point, the House and Senate on the House side, it's sections 46 to 58, R75 to R81 of your side-by-side. There are a number of provisions that MDE made regarding American Indian education proposals. They are the same in the House and the Senate with a couple of exceptions. For example, Section 49 of the House file has no Senate companion. These sections address schools, programs, activities, licensing, employment, paraprofessionals, community involvement, technical assistance, and tribal interaction for American Indians with the department.
Madam Chair, members, if you get down to the bottom of R81, going into R82, is a Senate-only provision which changes the American Indian Education Grant Program into an aid program.
Madam Chair, members, sections 59 in the House and 60 in the House, 59 beginning on R84 and 60 on R88, have no Senate companions. They pertain to achievement and integration in Minnesota. These are amendments to an existing law. Among other provisions in this section, there is a requirement to eligible districts to use their achievement gap elimination aid to improve all students' academic achievement and limit disparities among categories of students through various programs and activities that are listed in this section. The language allows eligible districts to use the integration levy to promote racial and academic integration. It allows eligible districts to use integration aid and levy to recruit and retain a diverse core of administrators and teachers. And it also provides incentives for teachers to teach in hard-to-staff classrooms and schools. Subdivision 2 in that section requires a comprehensive plan with goals to eliminate disparities in students' academic achievement and promote academic success. The language directs eligible school districts to implement cost-effective interventions. It allows districts to collaborate in creating efficiencies and eliminate duplicative programs and services. There is a requirement that school boards publicly report their progress on realizing stated achievement goals and to discuss their integration plans as well. There is language directing the districts to submit a budget to the commissioner, including a budget for integration activities where applicable. The language requires districts to measure progress based on student growth and progress in reading and math, student performance and achievement measures, and this is all according to a prescribed timeline. There is a direction to the commissioner to evaluate plans' efficacy in eliminating these disparities in student achievement and, where applicable, realizing economic and racial integration. And the commissioner is required to report to the legislature every fourth year. This section is effective for revenue for fiscal year 2016 and later. It gives districts through until the 2016-2017 school year to conform their plan to the requirements of this section. Section 60 on R88, having to do with the achievement gap elimination revenue and integration levy, renames the revenue formula, reduces the portion of revenue reserved for department administrative expenses. It establishes a formula for calculating a district's initial achievement gap elimination revenue. It contains formulas for aid, for levy, It requires at least 90% of a district's aid to be used for academic programs. It allows up to 5% of the aid to be used for professional and staff development and placement services. It allows up to 5% of the aid to be spent on administrative services. It requires the achievement gap elimination aid to be reserved and used only for specified programs. It requires the levy to be reserved and used only for an adopted integration plan. It allocates funding to the department for purposes of oversight and accountability services.
Madam Chair, members, on R90, Section 62 of the Senate file, is literacy incentive aid, and the section strikes some obsolete language, but then also makes the receipt of proficiency aid and growth aid contingent upon a district submitting to their local literacy plan to the commissioner.
Madam Chair, members, 61 in the House on R92 of the side-by-side is consistent with an earlier House proposal on the transfer curriculum. This section requires all MNSCU institutions to give full credit to a PSEO student who completes a post-secondary course or program for post-secondary credit at a MNSCU institution and then who enrolls in a MNSCU institution. Section 62 of the House has no Senate companion. It has to do with unrequested leaves of absence. It applies beginning in the 2017-2018 school year and would prohibit a school board and the exclusive representative of the teachers from executing an employment contract unless that contract contains an unrequested leave of absence plan or plan for discontinuing or terminating teachers.
Madam Chair, members, Section 22 of the Senate file with the operative language on R93 clarifies the calculation for an achievement and integration levy.
Madam Chair, members, I think Section 63 in the Senate and 63 in the House and 65 in the Senate are similar, but the Senate has more changes. The House indicates that the sites of a charter school not receiving QCOMP funding are eligible for fiscal year 2015 teacher development and evaluation revenue.
And then the Senate file has a separate section that with the operative language on R94. That allows educational cooperative and educational districts to receive that same teacher development revenue.
Madam Chair, members, Section 64 in the House on R94 has no Senate companion. This complements earlier sections in the House having to do with out-of-state teachers and the number of licenses issued to applicants. This section directs the Board of Teaching to report to the legislature by February 15, 2016, on the number of agreements with other states, which states participate in the agreements, what the content of the agreements indicate in terms of granting full licensure to qualified out-of-state candidates. Section 65 in the House on R95 has no Senate companion. This is one more provision related to the transfer curriculum. This would direct the MNSCU chancellor to report to the legislature on implementing the transfer curriculum policy for PSEO students and, in addition, recommend how to standardize AP, IB, and CLEP course equivalencies across the state colleges and universities. Section 66 in the House, for which there is no Senate companion, provides for an integration levy adjustment for fiscal year 2016 only.
Madam Chair, members, Section 25 of the Senate file on R95 is the agricultural educator grants, and that is a grant program to help school districts in paying ag education teachers for work with over the summer with high school students. Then towards the bottom of R95 is Section 26 of the Senate file, which establishes a concurrent enrollment working group to be convened by the Commissioner of Education. Then moving right along, at the bottom of R97 is Section 27 of the Senate file, which requires the commissioner to use existing budgetary resources to inventory and report on the statewide swimming resources.
I know, right?
And then continuing on to R98, Senate file section 66, for which there is not a comparable House section, is the allowing for the 2015-2016 school year only, for allowing school districts to begin school on September 1st. And then, Madam Chair and members, section 68 of the Senate file, which most of that language is on R99, is a work group or a group of stakeholders called by the Department for Career and Technical Educator Licensing. Then on R99, section 69 of the Senate file is a report from the commissioner on the developmental course taking and for high school students once or Minnesota high school graduates at Minnesota institutions of higher education, and linking those students to their high schools from which they graduated. Then section 70 of the Senate file requires the Board of Teaching to make recommendations to the legislature on teacher preparation and licensure requirements in the area of service learning. Then going on to R99 through a few pages are the appropriation sections, which will be outlined when the tracking sheets are walked through, gone through.
Yeah, thanks.
That takes you to R114, which are the repealers.
Madam Chair, members, the House, which was included in House File 2, proposes to repeal the statutory unrequested leave of absence plan for teachers generally, effective for the 2017-2018 school year.
The Senate repealers are dissimilar from the House. They relate to, first, the repeal of the Educational Planning and Assessment System Program, EPAS, and then also that's 120B.128, which there's more of that actually in Article 3 with standards and assessments. And then also the Senate repeals 120B.35, Subdivision 5, which is improving graduation rates for students with emotional and behavior disorders. And then 126C.12, Sub 6, is the Learning and Development Revenue and Annual Report. And then the repeal of Minnesota rules relates to the flexible learning year programs, which I think were outlined in Article 1.
All right. Any questions on Article 2? All right. Seeing none, we'll move forward to Article 3.
Madam Chair, members, Article 3 has to do with standards and assessment. On page R1 of Article 3, the House has a provision for which there is no Senate companion. It requires high school students, and by the by, I think, depending on how we proceed, in some cases we refer to students in grade 9 in the 2015-2016 school year, and elsewhere we refer to students grade 8 in the 2014-2015 school year, which has the same effect, but we should just decide which reference we're going to use. Anyway, in Section 1 in the House on R1, there is a requirement that high school students enrolled in grade 8 in the 2014-2015 school year and later take state-developed reading, writing, and math tests instead of a nationally normed college entrance exam as a condition of graduating from high school.
And Section 1 of the Senate file, with the operative language on R2, directs the department to adopt the most recent National Association of Sport and Physical Education standards and benchmarks for FIAD for students in kindergarten through grade 12. Then section 2 is rulemaking related to the physical education standards. Then section 2 of the House file and section 3 of the Senate file are the same, but the Senate does something else in another section separate from that. But that is the review of the benchmarks and standards for the mathematics and pushing that back to 2020-2021 school year. Then the Senate file also has some language related to the physical education standards and benchmarks and review for those beginning in the 2024-2025 school year and every 10 years thereafter.
Madam Chair, members, Section 3 of the House on R3 of your side-by-side has no Senate companion. This particular section relates back to several provisions in Article 2 that both the House and the Senate are proposing on world language proficiency certificates and seals. This language directs school districts to use the world language standards developed by the American Council on the Teaching of Foreign Languages. And this is the same reference that appears in Article 2. Section 4 of the House and Section 6 of the Senate on R4 of your side-by-side are similar. Both the House and the Senate propose to allow an agriculture science or career and technical education credit to fulfill an elective science credit if certain conditions are met, and also allows a computer science credit to fulfill a math credit if state academic standards in math are met.
The Senate file has additional language allowing Project Lead the Way credit to fulfill science or math credit if it meets the state academic standards in science or math. Then moving on to R6, Section 4 of the Senate file, are a new section related to physical education and allowing for allowing for a student to be excused from physical education class and another subdivision related to the qualifications of the teachers for physical education. Okay. Then Section 5 of the House file and Section 7 of the Senate file are different. The Senate file requires a school district's long-term strategic plan for the world's best workforce to include a process for determining grade promotion as well as our grade retention that supports student progress and growth towards college and career readiness.
Madam Chair, members, the House proposal having to do with the world's best workforce in Section 5 on R5 includes students' performance on the high school reading, writing, and math MCAs, indicating post-secondary readiness as a measure of progress in creating the world's best workforce. Madam Chair, members, Section 6 in the House, Section 9 in the Senate on R6 are the same. Both House and Senate strike a cross-reference to a statutory reference to the EPAS program that is offered as part of the ACT. This is repealed later on. Madam Chair, members, Section 7 in the House and Section 10 in the Senate both amend the statewide testing provisions. There are some similarities and some differences. Among other provisions in the House section is a transition from the suite of assessments back to the MCAs. There's a requirement that students take the MCAs and students in grade 8 in the 2014-2015 school year and later take MCAs in reading, writing, and math in order to graduate. On R10 of your side-by-side, there is language encouraging students to participate in a nationally recognized college entrance exams, and there's a requirement that districts pay one time for the cost of an interested student in grade 11 or 12 to take that exam, but the district pays for students who would be eligible for a meal benefit. On R12, there is a direction to the Education Commissioner in consultation with the Minsky Chancellor to identify minimum score guidelines on the reading, writing, and math MCAs that demonstrate readiness for a certificate program or a two-year or four-year college program. On R13, paragraphs M, N, and O, among other things, require the Education Commissioner to administer computer adaptive reading and math assessments that are aligned with state academic standards to students in grades 3 through 8 instead of 3 through 7.
Excuse me. The Senate language eliminates the grade 8 Explore and the grade 10 plan, as well as the Compass test, and then directs districts and schools to use career exploration elements to help students and their families explore and plan for post-secondary education or careers. And then also just makes a lot of technical adjustments, restructuring the assessment statute, so you'll see things stricken but then restated elsewhere without changes to the current law as it stands. And that would, I think, get us to R18. So
R15. Is that right? R15.
The section, was it 8 of the House file, section 11 of the Senate file, are similar, but the Senate file language is more of the technical adjustments to the testing structure with the
paper examinations.
And then requires the department to provide paper assessments for districts to administer to students if the districts request that. And that is on R16 at line 15.24 on the Senate side.
Madam Chair, members, Section 8 on the House side has many fewer changes and the changes that they are there are to conform with the changes in the previous section on the statewide testing system.
Then now I think we're on Section 14 of the Senate file on page R18, and that is some language from the agency on the establishing the usage of statewide assessment data by districts, and then also more technical changes to the current law for statewide assessments. Then Section 12, at the bottom of R18, special and extenuating circumstances, that directing the department to develop such a list for which students may be unable to test. Then section 13, so the operative language is on R19, and that directs the commissioner to establish empirically derived benchmarks on assessments. Oh, did I skip one? Nope.
Sorry.
That's just some paragraphing.
I think that makes.
All right. Then section 15 on R19 is access to tests, which is actually just technical language, but with the existing law of the commissioner having a policy for parental access or review to Minnesota developed assessments instead of naming the assessments. Then section 5 is some new language that's in the Senate file only, allowing the Department of Education to have up to 100 non-public pupils in grades 11 or 12 to take the ACT exam on the same state testing dates. Then section 6, where the operative language is in R20, allows or requires the commissioner to notify the education committees, the chairs and ranking minority members of the education committees, if there is a suspension of assessments. Then section 16 is a limitation on standardized testing, limiting to for students in grades 1 through 6 to 19 hours, and then for students in grades 7 through 12, not exceeding 20 hours, excluding AP and IB exams from that time limit, and allowing for an exemption from the time limit if there's an agreement with the teachers and they report the reasons for the requirement or exceeding the time limit in their World's Best Workforce plan. And then section 17 is just a technical change, adding the statutory reference for for statewide testing. Section 7 is related to the physical education. The operative language is on R21, and including in the school performance report the amount of time scheduled for students to be spending in physical education classes. Then section 8 on R22, for which there is not a comparable House position, our language, there is a direction to the commissioner to research whether the MCAs could be replaced by the measure of academic progress assessments and MAP assessments. And then section 9 is a direction about the disruption of assessments and allowing for a student's results to be excluded from for the purposes of growth and or school performance reports. Then section 10 is a reallocation of payment reductions if there is determined to be one for a with the contract between the assessment provider and the commissioner, and distributing that to school districts and charter schools. And then section 11 is a report to the legislature by the commissioner on the performance of the Minnesota Assessment System contractor. And then section 67, which the operative language is on R23, is a report on students' proficiency in the foreign languages when the ACT-FL assessments are not available. And then that gets us to appropriations. And then on R25 are the repealers, and the Senate ones are repeated from the end of Article 2. But the what's the same there is that both the House file and the Senate file repeal the EPAS system. That's Article 3.
All right. Any questions on Article 3? All right. Seeing none, we'll move forward to Article 4.
I don't blame you. Take a break.
Madam Chair, members, Article 4 has to do with charter schools. Both the House and the Senate have a number of technical provisions that are proposed by the reviser. This is in anticipation of a recodification of the charter school sections. As you may know, the section is getting to be very, very long. Several years ago, there was a direction in one in the omnibus K-12 bill asking the reviser to recodify the charter school law, and so a number of the provisions leading to that recodification appear in both the House and Senate bills. In addition, there are other provisions. Among them, Section 1 on R1 on the House side has no Senate companion. It requires a school district that provides transportation services on behalf of a charter school to allow non-resident charter school pupils who attend a charter school located in the district to ride the bus between scheduled stops. It also allows the school district to charge a fee which may not exceed the lesser of 15 cents a mile or the actual transportation costs per mile. Section 2 in the House the comparable provision in the Senate is from the reviser. This just reletters paragraphs. Section 3 on R2 in the House Section 34 in the Senate, among other technical sections, affects authorizers. There is a requirement that a charter school authorizer that intends to withdraw as an authorizer for reasons that are unrelated to causes for non-renewal or termination of a charter contract to provide written notice, and the language also establishes the timelines for that notice.
And the Senate carries the timeline in a separate section, because we separated out our recodification as other changes to the charter school laws. So you'll see, I think, on R8, lines 46.29 to 46.30, about the same, the timeline.
Madam Chair, members, regarding the formation of school, that is Section 4, beginning on R9, the side-by-side includes a reference to paragraph G, but it should be paragraph G in Section 5, not in Section 4. There are two paragraph Gs, and there is one for Section 4 and one for Section 5, but the description of paragraph G actually belongs in Section 5. Section 4, having to do with the formation of a school, has changes that the reviser is proposing, among other things. It also requires an authorizer to file an affidavit to charter a new school at least 14 months before July 1 of the year in which the charter school begins to serve students.
Madam Chair, members, the same language about the 14 months is in the Senate file in Section 35 on page R13, if you look at 48.1 to 48.2.
Madam Chair, members, Section 5 in the House and Section 36 in the Senate, among other Senate sections, has to do with federal, state, and local requirements. There is language that prevents, and this was suggested by the department, incidentally, that prevents the hours a student is enrolled in a fee-based kindergarten program from generating pupil units or being used to calculate general education revenue. There are some reviser changes. In addition, there is language allowing a charter school to offer a fee-based preschool or pre-kindergarten program, and there is language prohibiting charter schools from charging tuition except for fee-based preschool or pre-kindergarten programs. There is also language allowing charter schools where at least 90% of enrolled students have a primary disability of deaf or hard of hearing to also enroll pre-kindergarten students with a disability. This is one of a number of provisions suggested by the Commission on Deaf and Hard of Hearing to accommodate the concerns of that commission's constituency, including in other articles of this bill.
And Madam Chair, members, the Senate carries the language regarding the fee-based pre-kindergarten programs, R17. Starting 51.22 down to 51.26, and then in addition, if you look at R19, the Senate has the language regarding a charter school with at least 90% of enrolled students that are eligible for special ed services. That is at 59.28 through 59.31. And then, sorry, changes from the recodification on in the Senate and R21 technical changes and then and through R22 or R23 actually, but the has language regarding the or clarification regarding the subject to the charter schools being subject and complying with the public school fee law.
Madam Chair, members, Section 6 in the House and Section 37 in the Senate have some similar provisions, but the Senate has a number of additional provisions. The House allows a charter school offering a free preschool or pre-kindergarten program to give enrollment preference to those same children who are eligible to enroll in kindergarten in the next school year. This would be effective beginning the 2015-2016 school year.
The Senate file has language, if you look on R24, allowing a charter school to give an enrollment preference to children eligible for free or reduced-priced lunch when the percent of the students enrolled in that charter school who are eligible for free and reduced-priced lunch is lower than either the statewide percent of students who are eligible for the similar meals or the district-wide percent of students who are eligible for the free and reduced-priced lunches. And then if also has language, the Senate further down at 54.16, that if a charter school has established an early admission policy for entering school, they have to comply or describe the requirements for to determine the child's eligibility to enter kindergarten early. And then Section 38 of the Senate file, starting at R25, allows for different pupil performance measures for certain charter schools. Then now down to R27. Section 7 of the House file and Section 2 of the Senate file are similar. There's a the charter school for that allows a enrolls a pre-kindergarten pupil with a disability has to comply with certain sections and rules relating to the interagency early childhood intervention system as though it were a district. Oh, yeah, actually, there's the same, but because then we have the same reference to a technical addition that reference was missed to 125A.75. The Senate carries that in the policy bill, so it's in a separate section. Then the next section is Section 8 of the House file, Section 40 of the Senate file. Are allowing for a charter school to combine their annual report into the World's Best Workforce Report, and that's the same in both bills.
Madam Chair, members, Section 9 of the House on R28 having to do with pupil transportation. This is consistent with Section 1 in this article on the House side. It requires a school district to provide transportation to scheduled stops for a non-resident charter school pupil, consistent with the language in Section 1. Section 10 of the House has no comparable Senate provision. It appears on R29 and 30. It allows a charter school authorizer to terminate an existing charter school contract if in the previous three consecutive school years the performance of the charter school based on federal and state accountability measures related to student performance would place the school in the bottom 10% of all public schools as determined by the Education Commissioner. The language requires a charter school to be closed according to applicable law and the governing contract. If the authorizer terminates the contract, The authorizer under these circumstances must work with the board of directors to make parents aware of the school choice options available to them under these circumstances and assist the families to choose appropriate schools for the next school year for their students. It also requires an authorizer that does not terminate a contract under these circumstances to justify the decision to the commissioner. There is a statement indicating that the measures established under this paragraph would not preclude an authorizer from closing a school for other reasons. Madam Chair, members, Section 11 on the House, on R30, Section 40 on the Senate, having to do with mergers, both establish a process to accomplish the merger for interested charter schools. On R31, Section 12 of the House, and the similar provision in the Senate contain revisor corrections, as does Section 13 in the Senate. I'm sorry, Section 13 in the House with its comparable Senate companion. There are, again, revisor corrections. And then on R43, you can see appropriations.
That's the end of Article.
We were just debating how long we were going to go. Senate Finance is in here at 6, so we have to vacate the room so they can get ready to come in. I don't know. Do you think we can get through another article?
Let's try.
All right, we'll start. Maybe we'll, if we don't finish it, we'll come back to it tomorrow when Senator Wieger has to gavel. All right, so let's go ahead and start with Article 5.
Madam Chair and members, Article 5 is a special education article. The first section is on the Senate side, describing an elementary discipline policy. Excuse me, it would require a district to adopt a discipline policy for elementary pupils, outlining effective alternatives to suspension. Suspension is allowed only when alternatives are attempted and in certain circumstances. Section 2 actually begins on the bottom of that page and directs the school district to develop a program to address the underlying causes of disruptive behavior. Section 3 continues on page R2. Requires the superintendent to annually report on the effectiveness of interventions and strategies to reducing suspensions. Section 4 on page R2 requires the board to report through the department's electronic reporting system the elements in current law, but also written agreement of parents to withdraw a child as an alternative to expulsion. Section 5, alternatives to pupil suspension, describes some alternatives. The new language is at lines 21 through 25. Section 6, policy components. The changed language is at the bottom, begins at the bottom of page R3, and makes reference to the use of mobile crisis response teams. It strikes language with regard to students with a serious emotional disturbance or other students on an IEP. Section 7 begins at the top of page 4 and requires the school administrator to make efforts to immediately contact the parent of any student who is removed from a school building or school grounds by a peace officer unless that notification would be otherwise prohibited by law. Section, still on page R4, Section 1 in the House language, Section 8 in the Senate language. In, I think in most respects this is the same, and basically updates references from the Minnesota Resource Center serving deaf and hard of hearing to the deaf and hard of hearing state specialist housed at the department. And you can see these references continue through to page R6. Page R6, Section 3 in the House, Section 10 in the Senate would require, well, it, in regard to providing transportation, clarifies the school board's responsibility to providing transportation for a child with a disability not yet enrolled. Clarifies that the transportation is that transportation is required for special instruction for a child placed in early childhood programs to address the child's level of functioning needs. This is identical language in the House and Senate. Page R7, Section 1 on the Senate side. This matches up in some respects to a section in Article 1 in the House side. This is general education revenue for a charter school. Makes the same conforming changes in paragraph A to extended support revenue, but beginning in paragraph B is the first of several sections that have the effect of accelerating special education aid and general education aid for certain charter schools that have very high rates of pupils on an IEP. Section 2 is a conforming technical change. The paragraph referenced at line 25. Section 3 defines, for the purposes of this accelerated special and general education aid, defines unreimbursed costs and eligible special education charter school. You can see that the schools eligible would have at least 90% prevalence of students eligible for special ed services and submit a preliminary annual budget to the commissioner. Section 4, again, is related to this accelerated aid. There's a lot of highly technical language that I would be happy to describe, but it all has the effect of, for these eligible special education charter schools, accelerating the aid to that charter school because they very often have certain cash flow problems related to the special ed reimbursements. Sections 4, now we're on page R9, Section 4 in the House language, Section 63 in the Senate language, they're quite similar, defines dyslexia. The language that's different, members should note, on the Senate side, the last sentence of that subdivision indicates a diagnosis of dyslexia must not be the sole basis for qualification for special education services under the special education chapter. And the House language, I think, has a similar intent, but perhaps Mr. Strom or Ms. Larson can describe any differences.
Yes. Madam Chair, members, on R9, 126.21 and 126.22 is the sentence that I believe is being discussed here. You can compare the last sentence in the Senate section with this sentence here, and I think that's the point of this comparison in terms of what the overall intent might be. So the House states that students who have a dyslexia diagnosis must meet state and federal eligibility criteria. Whether that means the same thing as what the Senate states, I think, is the question.
On to the middle of page R9, there's a number of sections here all relating to interagency intervention service system. They're the same in the House and Senate. This would be House sections 5, 6, 7. Basically updates references to interagency early intervention committees conforming with changes from previous legislative session. There's a bunch of new language on page R12 that I believe is mostly just a restructuring of language that's already there and making it more clear and again conforming with changes from previous legislative sessions. The next section that would be different would be the House Section 8, beginning on page R14, corresponding with Senate Section 14. There is the side-by-side summary indicates that it's the same, but I will note for members that it's not word for word the same, though the intent is quite similar. There's different language in House paragraph L on page R15. The Senate keeps existing language indicating that these paraprofessional training has to happen before or immediately upon employment. The House uses slightly different words there, but I think the intent is quite similar.
Madam Chair, members, if I may, this is part of a bill that Representative Christensen carried, and this language, if I remember correctly, was developed at least in part at the request of the Minnesota School Boards Association.
Madam Chair, members, on page R16, Section 9 in the House, Section 15 in the Senate, this has to do with the student information system transferring records. They're quite similar. The Senate language makes reference to a system that is schools interoperability framework or SIF compliant. The House uses a more general term. Maybe that's all there is to say about that. Section 10 in the House, Section 16 in the Senate, again, very similar and related to the online reporting of required data. I think the difference is in the middle of page R17, paragraph C. I think the intent is the same. The Senate language makes reference to at line 25 for the 2015-16 and later school years, and the House language just kind of reorders the phrases there, but I think the essential intent of the provision is the same.
Madam Chair, members, on R18, Section 11 of the House has no Senate companion. It has to do with physical holding or seclusion. It allows but doesn't require stakeholders to recommend reductions in the use of restrictive procedures to the Education Commissioner. On R20, third-party payment, that's the same in both the House and the Senate, and it has to do with references to Part C. These are clarifications recommended by the Department.
Madam Chair, members, on page R23 on the Senate side, this again is another section related to the acceleration of general and special education aids for these eligible charter schools. The new language is in paragraph B in the middle of page R24. Page R25 begins House Section 13, Senate Section 18. This is the same language in both bodies, and it allows the State Interagency Coordinating Council 30 days to recommend policies after receiving Part C annual performance report from the Office of Special Education. Page R26, Section 14 in the House, Section 19 in the Senate. Again, the same language, making technical changes to reflect that the duties of the Resource Center for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing are now carried out by the specialist at the Department of Education. Section 15 in the House, Section 20 in the Senate, the language is the same. Again, technical changes related to the resource centers. Section 16 with regard to the advisory committees and Section 21 on the Senate side, most of the language is the same, except that the House adds a reference to the Committee for the Blind and Visually Impaired on line 30 and 143.2 and 3. On page R27, Section 17 in the House, Section 22 in the Senate, this is the same language in both bodies. It makes technical changes to reflect that the duties, again, of the Resource Center for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing are now carried out by the state specialist at MDE. Page R28, definitions. This is the same in both bodies, and it clarifies that special education aid is paid directly to cooperatives, education districts, and immediate districts beginning in fiscal 16. This is a conforming change to legislation that was passed in the 2013 session. Section, now we're on page R29, section 19 in the House, special education aid. This is the same language in both bodies, and again is related to the direct payment of aid to cooperatives, education districts, and intermediate districts. Page R30, on the Senate side, there is technical language, in the middle of page R31. The last time this section was amended, a word was erroneously excluded from paragraph C. So the amendment here includes, or the effect of the amendment is to exclude transportation sparsity revenue, local optional, and total operating capital revenue from the definition of general education revenue for the purposes of calculating special education aids. Section 8, payment dates and percentages. This, again, is related to the accelerated aid. The new language is on the bottom of page R34 on the Senate side. Section 9 on page R35. This, again, is a conforming change related to the accelerated payment of aids to eligible charter schools and ensures that special education aid paid to a resident district is reduced in an equal amount to the accelerated aid for the charter school pupil.
Madam Chair, members, on R36, section 20 in the House, there is a Senate section that appears across from it in your side-by-side, and they may have some substantively similar language, but the proposals are distinct. The House section contains a number of recommendations from the legislative auditor on special education. In subdivision one, there is language directing the education department to identify ways to help special education teachers make decisions about complying with special education laws. There is a direction to the department to work collaboratively with school and district staff and interested organizations to identify obstacles to and solutions for complying with special education laws. And there is a direction to the department to help provide staff development training. Subdivision 2 regards the effort to reduce the time that teachers spend completing paperwork to evaluate whether such strategies are cost-effective, and the department is directed to disseminate successful strategies related to reducing paperwork. Subdivision 3 directs the department to determine the reading level of the special education forms and decide whether alternative forms are needed to accommodate the users and readers of the forms. And that's where the similarity to the Senate proposal exists. Madam Chair, members, Section 21 in the House, Section 10, the Senate that appears on R37, contain the appropriations, which I believe you will review subsequently. And then Section 22, the repealer on the House side, and Section 26, the repealer on the Senate side, is consistent with a number of other sections having to do with the Commission on Deaf and Hard of Hearing, the state specialist, and transferring resource center duties to the department. And this repealer is among those sections.
With that, I think we'll save the rest of the articles for tomorrow since, again, we've been reminded to vacate the room before 6 o'clock. The Senate Finance Committee is coming in. Senator Wieger, did you have any announcements you wanted to make about tomorrow's meeting? I don't know if you've determined a time or...
Thank you, Madam Chair. And tentatively, we would meet 10 minutes after the last body adjourns. I would expect that would be shortly after 2 p.m. in here. I am told that there may be another meeting that some of the members in our caucus will have to be at 5:30. And so we're looking at about 3 to 3.5 hours for the meeting. And the tentative agenda would be to complete the rollout, with including the tracking charts, and then school facilities repairs, taking some testimony on that. And I discussed that briefly with Representative Loon, is something that we had spent a great deal of time on and wanted to share more information on that. The second would be on the QComp, lifting the cap, and just a bit of a background as to why that's included. And then student testing requirements and credits. We have a number of common provisions, but also some different points, and I thought it would be helpful to have a discussion and also invite some testimony on those items. We may add to this as well, depending on how we progress on the rollout and discussion.
Thank you. Any questions from any of the committee members at this point? Go ahead. On the books, I think each side is going to respectively keep them on the carts, or are we going to keep them all together?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe they'll all be put in the committee cart, or if the House wishes, you could take yours. But probably it's better to just put them all in the cart, and then they'll be up in room 205 secure.
We're going to keep ours in our own cart.
Okay, so the House will keep their materials in their own cart.
All right, so yes, any questions about anything? All right, with that, a special thanks to nonpartisan staff, and everybody's voices held up very well for a long session reading. So. Thank you, everyone, and we will see you tomorrow. Committee is adjourned.
Very good. You're sounding really good.